Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19 and other bugs you can catch this time of year. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
We spent a lot of our time on new research last week. I thought we could start off this week by just discussing the state of public health. It is the beginning of cold and flu season. Also, typically, although I don't think we can say reliably, a time of year when COVID cases have started to go up. I know the data has been unreliable because the CDC has been part of the government shutdown, and they produce a lot of the aggregated data. From what we have available to us, what do we know about how much of what is going around?
Well, we have individuals around the country who are putting an enormous amount of time in to compile the best data they can find about what's happening with the respiratory viral season. And I say fortunately, because if we didn't have those folks, we wouldn't have anything because of the government shutdown. It's been 40 days now since we've had any data from the CDC about COVID. It's very, very disappointing. The influenza data is lacking. Avian influenza is not being tracked adequately by our government. So we form governments to help us be safe. And the government is doing absolutely nothing right now. Been very disappointing. That said, we're still in a really good period in terms of the big three, RSV, COVID, and influenza. COVID is low here in California and low around most of the United States. It is wreaking its ugly head up. As you had mentioned a couple weeks ago, Brian, in Singapore and Japan, we've seen also an increase in COVID in England, which often presages what will occur here in the United States. So I think it's just a matter of weeks before we see some more COVID here, but it's a good time in reference to COVID. It's still also a good time in reference to influenza. Here in California, we're very low levels. Around much of the country, we're at very low levels. Hawaii's seeing an uptick. Some other states in the Southeast are seeing an uptick, but influenza remains very low. We are in RSV season. We've been in RSV season for a couple of weeks now. And when I say we're in the season, it's just starting to ramp up now throughout much of the United States. So we will see RSV continue to ramp up. It's pretty predictable that we're going to see a lot of it beginning right around Thanksgiving time or after Thanksgiving. So enjoy these next 2 or 3 weeks, because I think that after Thanksgiving, or even before, with all the travel, climate, the weather gets colder, people indoors more, at least here in California, we're likely to see an uptick in all three of those.
What about avian influenza? I keep catching headlines in passing about outbreaks either on farms like chicken farms or in wildlife populations. How concerning is the level of viral activity there right now?
I don't know what the level of viral activity is right now, because as I said, the United States, through the USDA and the CDC, are shirking their responsibility by not monitoring it more carefully, by not being more aggressively in terms of following up on cases. So we really don't know a lot about what's happening to avian influenza. What we do know is coming from the states, and what we have seen is that a seasonal pattern, it looks like. That is that I think your listeners will remember that the price of eggs was really high last year because in the winter and spilling into the spring, we saw so many chickens being culled. We saw outbreak after outbreak. We were still seeing lots of cases in cows, and therefore the concerns about the dairy situation. But then by mid-spring, things had really tapered off, and the number of cullings that had to take place dropped dramatically. We had just sporadic ones throughout the summer. What we're seeing now is, over the last month or so, an uptick in cases. And when I say an uptick, to give that some meaning, as of this late fall, spring, excuse me, late fall that we're in, and even mid fall, we've had to cull in the United States around 3.5 million chickens, chickens which would have otherwise been available both for laying eggs as well as for eating. So it's coming back. And we attribute this, at least in large part, to the fly patterns of birds, that they're starting to come back to the United States on their typical patterns of flying throughout the seasons. So that's probably a good part of the explanation, but I don't know if it's how big a part of it is, because, again, we just don't have adequate epidemiology. And the reason for that is that we don't have a government that's trying to keep us safe.
What about the virological data on bird flu's progress towards becoming something that can do well enough to spread from person to person? I guess it's become an area of concern because the current strains have gotten into a lot of mammalian populations. They've like wreaked havoc in elephant seal populations in the Southern Hemisphere. How close is it to being something people have to worry about?
We don't know. In terms of how close is it to something people should worry about, I think everybody should be very concerned about this. But we're not, as I said, paying attention to it. So if we don't see it, if we don't follow it, we don't know how concerned we should be. But I think that's clearly the concern. To date, this virus has not figured out how to efficiently transmit person to person. We've seen some studies in the last month that suggest that it won't take a large genetic change for this virus to accomplish that. As you point out, there are scores of mammals that can be infected with this virus, that are infected with this virus. So the possibility of eradicating this virus is not something we can see in the foreseeable future at all. So this virus has learned how to infect lots of different life forms on this planet, mammals, and it's very likely going to continue to infect humans on a sporadic basis. Whether it will learn how to infect, I'm anthropomorphizing the virus when I say learn, but whether it will evolve to effectively infect human beings and then effectively transmit from human to human, we just don't know.
I was just kind of stunned reading an article when I read that some southern elephant seal colonies saw 97% mortality rate among pups from bird flu. We're speaking to Dr. John Swartzberg. He is clinical professor emeritus of infectious diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. He is here to answer your questions for the remainder of the hour. It is 1-800-958-9008. That's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. First question comes from our inbox, Dr. Swartzberg. The person who wrote in did not sign their name at the bottom, so I won't read the one attached to their email address. They ask, today, this would be last week, Dr. S. explained at what intervals to get the vaccine. My question is, how long should one wait to get a vaccine after getting a mild case of the virus?
Good question. And the way I look at it is that if you've been infected with the virus, mild case, moderate case, severe case, that you have received a vaccination. You know, the people think about vaccines as so different than the wild type infection. But what a vaccine does is it gives you protection. It stimulates the same part of the immune system to protect you, but without all the other consequences that the virus can do. So look at this episode of this person having had a mild case of COVID. That means that he or she has been vaccinated. So it would be the same schedule that you would follow for the vaccine schedule, depending upon your risk factors for a bad outcome from COVID.
So if you have a lot of risk factors, the soonest you might get vaccinated after an infection, 4 months out,
the soonest,
otherwise 6 months out?
Right. So it depends upon how risky the situation is for you. If you're severely immunocompromised, your doctor may advise getting vaccinated every 2 or 3 months. The price you pay for that is you may not respond as well to the vaccine that often, but the advantage is that you do get a boost every 2 or 3 months, and that will protect you. For most people who are at high risk, that is age over 65, especially over 75, younger than that, including all the way down to very young children, if they have chronic heart, lung problems, diabetes, obesity, the whole list that everybody knows, including pregnancy, then it probably should be every 6 months, at least right now, that's our current thinking. If you're not at high risk, not in one of those categories, then it's really once a year to get vaccinated, and typically people are getting the vaccine in the fall. So those are the general recommendations. Again, these should be reviewed with your physician in terms of doing the calculus for what kind of level of risk of a bad outcome you are personally in.
All right. 1-800-958-9008 to put a Corona Call question to Dr. John Swartzberg. First up, we've got Holly in Idaho. Good morning, Holly.
Good morning. My question for Dr. Swartzberg is, can I get the COVID booster now? I'm just now at 6 months, and I was just exposed to somebody with COVID.
So is your question whether it would help prevent that exposure turning into an infection if you got the booster right now?
No, I just wonder if there's any reason not to do that. I'm not thinking at all. Yes, because I'm now 6 months since my last one.
Gotcha.
Got it.
Dr. Swartzberg?
Yeah, there's no reason for you to hold off getting it because you were exposed to somebody. You're exposed to somebody, you may come down with COVID. If you do come down with COVID, it's unlikely. We don't have a lot of data on this, but it's unlikely that getting vaccinated after exposure will modify your illness if you get sick. So the worst case scenario for you, Holly, would be that you come down with COVID, you get well, and then you wait 6 months because you've now been immunized because you've had the COVID, and you've also had the shot, the vaccine. Wait 6 months or a year, depending upon your risks, for your next vaccine. So bottom line, it's fine to go ahead and get vaccinated now, and hopefully you don't come down with COVID, you weren't infected, and you'll have good protection for a number of months.
Okay, good. What about the flu? I'm also due for the flu shot. I don't like to get them together because frequently I have responses to the shots. So should I just go ahead and get that two weeks after I have the COVID vaccine?
Sure. And unless you become ill with COVID, then I'd wait till you've gotten over COVID to do that.
Right.
But sure, there's no contraindication. There's no risk to you by getting the flu shot, even though you may be incubating COVID.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hope that helps, Holly. Stay warm there in Idaho. 1-800-958-9008 to put a Corona Calls question to Dr. John Swartzberg. We'll go back to the inbox for our next question. Mariana in Alameda writes, my parents, both of whom are 80, got the vaccine in October and were told by Kaiser to come back for their, quote, second shot this month. Is this necessary?
No. There's some confusion here. They're 80 years old, so they're in a high-risk group. So my recommendation would be to get vaccinated every 6 months. You don't need more than one vaccine at a time. What going back to the beginning of the pandemic, our listeners may recall that to start with the vaccine series, we gave the first shot, and then we waited at least a month for the second shot. That was because nobody had been exposed to COVID at that point. And so no one had immunity. And so two shots were felt to be necessary to get people's immune system up to date. Well, fast forward almost 6 years. As a matter of fact, this month, it's been 6 years since this virus, SARS-CoV-2, entered the human population. So this vaccine, this time around, it's just one shot because you have immunity from the past. So this is just a booster. So I'm not sure what happened. Either there was some communication from Kaiser to Marianne's parents. I don't know, but unless there's something that is particular about their situation and they should check with their doctor.
I was somewhat confused by the question as well. I wondered if this might not be the extraordinarily unlikely case of two 80-year-olds who have never been infected and also not been vaccinated in the 5 years that the vaccine has been available, starting from scratch. Is it still a two-shot series for someone in that unlikely circumstance?
Well, we haven't really published a lot of data on that because we're assuming, and I think probably correctly, that almost everybody has either been vaccinated or infected or both. The only way to know if you've never been infected, because a lot of people get infected with this virus and never develop any symptoms at all. So these are called asymptomatic infections. The only way to know that is to do a specialized antibody test to see if the person has antibodies, and that would prove that they've been infected before. And that's not being done routinely. So from a public health standpoint, and even from an individual standpoint, we're assuming people have some degree of immunity, either from being infected by the wild type virus or being immunized.
Got it. But if you were either assuming that this person was completely immunologically naive or had gone out of your way to confirm it with an antibody test, if you were starting from scratch, it would be the two-shot series?
Yes, it would be. We'd be back to the winter of 2020. And you would get the first shot, and then you'd get a second one at a month, 6 weeks, 8 weeks later.
All right. Well, I think I'm not sure we understood the question, but I think we have explored every plausible answer to what the question might be.
Right.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines at 1-800-958-9008, where Aid is on the line here in Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. So I have a question about long-term COVID, which is very, very, I think it's not quite understood yet. But before that, I'll again repeat that bird flu H5N1 is only one mutation away from being airborne. If that is happening today with the horrible attitude of the current administration about vaccines and Robert F. Kennedy on that, we're going to have, you know, tens of million people die. And we should pay attention to that right away. As far as long-term COVID, I think that virus affects the whole body. Many of my friends, they had COVID. Luckily, I never did get it, but I was vaccinated. All of a sudden, they get total loss of memory. So the virus may be present in one form or another in our brains. And some people, and I had experience with a friend, a woman, 3 days ago. She just totally lost it. She didn't know where she was. She was in her own house. So if the doctor knows anything about that, please let us know. It is very critical time yeah. with COVID, bird flu, and everything else. Thank you very much.
So, Dr. Swartzberg, I think we can sort this into neurological symptoms during the acute phase of infection and signs of neurological impairment post-infection or during long COVID. What do we know?
Right. Well, we know that it exists. We know that, unfortunately, it's not uncommon for people to develop both acute and chronic symptoms that are neurological in nature. We don't know exactly why this occurs. There are competing hypotheses. There may be multiple reasons for this to occur, but we do know that this occurs both short-term and long-term. In terms of the short term, the acute infection, We know that any infectious disease that gives a significant fever or a significant inflammatory response throughout the body can certainly cause acute neurological symptoms, and they resolve with the resolution of the generalized inflammation and the high fevers. What the caller is talking about, I think, is long COVID, and we know that there are myriad neurological problems that occur and that can occur chronically after having had COVID. Fortunately, for most people, it resolves, but sometimes it takes months to a year or 2 years. And some people, we've been, at least to date, not seeing it resolve. And one of the manifestations of that is, as the caller mentioned, is that brain fog, where you feel this heaviness in your brain, and your brain just doesn't seem to be working correctly. And one of the manifestations of that is certainly memory. So I'm glad the gentleman called in, because I think that people are pretty much forgetting about long COVID. It doesn't occur as frequently now as it did at the beginning of the pandemic, but it certainly occurs now. And it's something nobody wants. And it's another reason to protect yourself against this virus.
I think something to keep in mind here is that the virus can definitely impact your brain, right? Like the loss of smell and taste that was a common symptom of infection early in COVID and lasted long after the fevers and other acute symptoms. That means your olfactory bulb is being impacted. That means your brain is being impacted either by the virus or the inflammatory response to the virus.
That's right. And that's not the only neurological manifestation. We've seen people develop what's called Bell's palsy, which is a paralysis of one side of their face. And that's from part of the nervous system being involved with the virus. It's not very common, but it certainly occurs. We've seen other parts of the body being affected in terms of the nerves that go to the heart or the gastrointestinal symptoms. So when we talk about the neurological symptoms, we're not just talking about what's underneath your skull, but it's all the way down the spinal cord and all of the projections of the nervous system throughout our body.
All right. We've got just over a minute left. Let's try to squeeze in one more quick question. Go to Oakland, where Frida is waiting patiently. Good morning.
Yes. Hi, good morning. My question is about parosmia, altered taste. I've had it for 6 months and it's not going away. I was wondering, usually does it come back? Is there anything we can do?
Thank you for that question, Frida. Good news is that this has been followed because we noted the altered taste very early in the pandemic as a manifestation of COVID. For most people, after about a year, it gets better and goes away for most people. Now we have good data out for 2 years. And for most people who got it within 2 years, there are very few people left with permanent loss of taste and smell. So it's statistically very likely that this will resolve with more time. All of that said, is there are things that can be done. And I think talking to an ear, nose, and throat physician would be appropriate since it's been 6 months for you. You can even retrain the nervous system, your ability to smell, for example. You can retrain that portion of your nervous system to teach you again how to smell things. So there are a variety of things that doctors can now do for that. So I would talk to an ear, nose, and throat person who has some expertise in this area.
Like physical therapy for your sense of taste. Dr. Swartzberg, thank you so much for spending another Monday morning with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. We ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiegert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.